Welcome to Maryland Solutions with Reverend Marilyn, the speaker for the new millennium. Join Marilyn as she talks with guests offering a wide range of talents and information. And now, here's Marilyn.
Welcome to Maryland Solutions. I'm so glad you're joining me again today. We're glad to have you back on our listening audience. And we have a guest here in the studio, Rebecca Smith, and she has brought several people with her in recovery from meth. First, I'd like to remind you that our people sponsoring this show today are Evelyn Mulvey of Partners Counseling. You can reach Evelyn at 253-839-3642 or email her at Evelyn Mulvey, care of hotmail.com, and restore your peace of mind. We also have a sponsor, Crystal Voyage, located in Freight House Square. Her phone number is 253-272-GEMS. Remember, that's your metaphysical supply store for all your needs. And we also are sponsored by Olala Treatment Center, who is here in force today with us. And you can reach them at 1-800-882-6201 or olala.org on your internet. We are so pleased to again let you know that Rebecca Smith, the marketing director of Olala Recovery Center, is here with us today. And I would like to welcome her on this new time show on methamphetamine addiction, methamphetamine. And she has also brought with us to hear some people that are going to be discussing this topic today, and we'd like to ask Rebecca some questions about what she could tell us about meth addiction.
Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for having us. Today we're going to talk about meth addiction. We're going to talk about what to do if you or a loved one have a problem with meth addiction, how to choose a good treatment program for meth addiction, and what does meth addiction treatment look like at Olala Recovery Centers. And then we have two people who are here that are going to share their recovery stories and try to put a face on recovery by talking to us about what happened, what it was like, and what happened after they've been sober.
Well, that sounds like a lot of information that our listeners will be really pleased to hear and information they might not be able to get someplace else. So we're really glad everyone's tuned in today. I would like to introduce the panel that she brought along with herself from Olala, and Terry Jones will be on our program. We'll be talking with her. She's the program director of Olala Recovery Centers. She will be sharing signs and symptoms of meth addiction and what meth addicts can expect in treatment at Olala Recovery Centers. Dan M. is here today. He's a recovering meth addict, sober for 2 years, a 42-year-old father and homeowner, and he was the former owner of a meth lab. Sounds fascinating to me already. We have Cheryl, who's here with us today, a recovering meth addict. She's sober for about 2.5 years. She's 22 years old and a student, and a person who had to embrace a new family in order to get and stay clean. What a challenge that must be. Also, we have Cheryl's new dad, Jack, with us to talk to us about the other side of addiction and treatment and the family experience. And myself, Rebecca, we'll be talking more about family interventions and choosing treatment centers like Olala and how that is set apart from other treatment centers. Why don't we start first with Cheryl and what it's like to be addicted to meth. Cheryl, could you ask us that?
It takes full control of your life. It it changes your personality. You know, all your morals and values disappear. It takes what you know from right to wrong, and it takes control of your life.
Can you share some experience that went on before you got into recovery? Is the pain and miseries that you went through before you determined that you had a problem?
Well, I grew up in a family of methamphetamine addiction. Both my biological parents were addicted. My older sister, 2 years older, was addicted. My brother, 4 years younger, was addicted. And then I was addicted. We would openly do it with anybody and everybody who was addicted. With the help of my new adopted family and some family friends, I found out I had a problem.
So obviously you weren't aware of that your life was different than what you might call a normal family up until you got into recovery?
Well, you know it's different. You just don't accept it as different. You, well, actually, me for myself, I can't speak for others. I was very, family was important to me. So I did everything I could to be a part of my family's life. So, you know, I'd listen to what other people would say, but, you know, they're not my parents, so I didn't accept it.
What was the incident that brought you into recognizing or accepting that there was something that you needed to look at?
Well, I got adopted at the age of 18, and I was still in contact with my biological family at that time, and I went back to drugs. I was clean for just over a year. I had a family who really truly loved me and taught me what family truly was, and that was not drug addiction. So they taught me what a real family was, and I decided that that's what I wanted, and I wanted to get clean.
How has your life changed since you have become a recovered person?
I enjoy sleep. That's probably the most important thing I've learned in my own personal growth. I enjoy my sleep today. I've been able to be honest with myself and others. And I've been able to grow in my schooling. I can sit down in a class and actually get a good grade instead of deciding I'm not going to go to class that day.
Cheryl, didn't you tell me once that your new family lived right down the street from your old family and still do?
Yeah, they live within about a mile and a half.
And so do you still see your biological parents?
No, I don't anymore.
So they're completely out of your life?
Yeah. Finally, yeah. It took about 4.5 years.
Well, that sounds like a painful change in some ways. Was that difficult for you to make the adjustment?
With how strong my feelings of family were, it was the most difficult thing that I ever had to deal with, was to disassociate myself from my biological family. I wanted to sit on the fence and play both sides. I wanted my newly adopted family, but then I felt obligated with my biological family. So yeah, I had to completely walk away from them and all my thoughts and patterns about that.
Well, that really takes courage. I want to really commend you, Cheryl, for taking the steps forward to improve your life and to get into a place where it's much healthier for you. I'll congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
Jack, would you like to share your perspective on how you came to adopt Cheryl?
Well, we met Cheryl and her family shortly after we moved into the neighborhood. And at the time, Cheryl was five, close to six, and so we knew her family in better days. And as Cheryl grew up and the family problems started becoming more pronounced, we weren't directly a part of it, but we were close enough that we could see what was happening.
What did you and your family go through in supporting her in recovery?
Well, when it finally became clear to us that there was a problem, we spent some time looking for a couple of places. You know, we didn't really know what we were looking for. Called around. Tried to evaluate them from what little information I had at the time, and somehow the Olala recovery program sounded like the best for Cheryl. We went out and took a look at it and talked to some of the people out there, and that's what we settled on. And it may not have been the most educated choice for us at the time, but it worked out very well, and it was a good match for Cheryl. So.
Well, I've been very impressed with Olala. I've been out there, and I've lectured, and I've taught, and I'm always impressed with the program there.
And we were, too.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I think they do a fine job. There are support programs for people that are families of recovering people in addiction. Have you ever attended any support classes or programs?
I hadn't. We had been relatively untouched by this up until what we all went through together with Cheryl. So I went through, and my wife went through some of the programs, the meetings that they had over there, while Cheryl was in her part of the program. Mm-hmm. And so we learned some about what was going on at the time, and how to deal with life after the recovery program, because it's not that long, and it's a continuing process after they leave the structured program there.
Well, we're so glad to have all of you here today. This is a real treat. I wish to remind our listeners that if they wish to reach me for counseling or to contribute to keeping this program on the air, they may call me at 253-845-4907, or you can email me at Marilyn, care of angelicasgifts.com. If you are interested in sponsoring this program, call the radio station KLAY at 253-584-1480. We're glad everyone's here, and we're going to be talking with some more people after the break. Stay tuned, and we'll see you in a few minutes. Thank you. Welcome back to Maryland Solutions. We are visiting today with people from Olalla Recovery Centers and their recovering people. We have Rebecca Smith, who has brought them over to join us today. I would like to let everybody know that next week, on February 6th, we will have Dr. James Wanless, Ph.D., who is a author of Way of the Great Oracle and his brilliant and revolutionary Voyager tarot deck. I have been enjoying his book this last week and finding it very interesting. I'm sure you will too. The following week, we have Dr. Gladys McGarry. Many people are familiar with her as a holistic doctor, and she has a clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, which she will share about with you. And the following week, we have Rob Grant, an author who has written many metaphysical books, including Are We Listening to the Angels? And his newest book, The Place We Call Home. He's going to be lecturing in Edmonds in February, and you won't want to miss that. Let's go back to our guests today on our panel, and we have Dan here with us. Dan, what was your life like addicted to meth?
Absolute insanity. You know, I can't describe it any better than that. You know, that was what drove me into recovery, and that's what was, I mean, I didn't, it was absolute insanity. I just, as close as I can.
Well, give us the day in the life of a meth addict so people can understand what happened.
Well, I can't really say, you know, a day wouldn't work.
Okay.
Because it wasn't a day. You know, it was one day, you get high, and then that day just keeps going on, you know. You can't keep track of what's night or day. Nighttime means you can make dope. Daytime means that you can't make dope. And that's pretty much, you know, when you're out of dope, it's usually a few days down the line. And it's time to get some more stuff to make some more dope.
And were you living with your family during this period?
Yes, I was.
So they were in the home?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I had some problems with my wife. We had a lot of problems between my wife and I at the time. So, more often than not, you know, I was either living there or not living there. But whether I was living there or not living there, I always had business out in the shed out behind the house.
Because you had a meth lab.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Coming and going, people coming and going, trying to keep it separate from the house. And keep away from the kids, and keep the kids from asking questions, but you're so caught up, I was so caught up in the insanity, you know, that it just got to the point, you know, it was just a mess.
Do you think the kids knew what was going on?
Yes, it would be hard, they knew something was going on, but they didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
you know. But they, our oldest daughter, you know, was starting to get ideas, you know, I believe, about what was going on.
May I ask what happened to get you into treatment? What was the circumstances?
Well, I was on probation for some unrelated charges, and in order to continue on, you know, on probation and be part of this program, I had to give urinalysis tests at my probation officers, and I could not, no matter how hard I tried, I'd go in every week to give up a urinalysis, and I could not give a clean one. You know, I couldn't keep away from the dope, and I couldn't understand why not, you know, and then I realized that there was a problem, you know, and I went before the judge in Gig Harbor, and he was made very clear with me that I had given up on myself, and my probation officer gave up on me, and I had given up on me, and everybody had given up on me except for the judge, and he decided to give me one more chance because I had went went to a doc site to get an application, you know, to get a bed space somewhere, and I requested to go to Lala. And I had to wait 3 weeks for the bed date, and that was just the most, you know, intense 3 weeks of my life, you know, just waiting. And then we got arrested, you know, for the meth lab. The police showed up, and I had already quit using dope, you know, but the police showed up, and there was still people in the well house, you know, making dope, you know, and I still wasn't in a recovery mode, you know. I was just abstinent from using drugs.
Yeah.
You know, so it was the realization of all that, you know, coming down. I had to go to jail for making dope, and I wasn't doing it anymore. You know, it was really, you know,
it's not fair, right?
No, it was horrible. And I realized that I was living in insanity, and I questioned my actual, you know, insaneness, and I was in fear of my brain. You know, I was very worried that I was out of touch with reality, so I had to go find out whether I was or not.
How has your life changed since recovery?
Oh, it's I've never lived this life before. I've been getting high since I was 11 years old, and before that, I was living my father's insanity. You know, so I mean, I've never experienced sobriety, this type of life ever before in my life. It's all every day's new. Everything I do is new.
I imagine you have more peace of mind today.
Oh, to say the least. I thought I had peace of mind when I was using, you know, because that was my reality. That was my social norm. That was everything that I'd ever known. And I thought it was just normal to hate and curse and steal and lie. And that was just normal. And people that didn't do that were weird. And and I somehow, in the back of my mind, I always knew that there was something else, but I didn't know what it was, and I wasn't, you know, I was too scared to try to find out what it was. Yeah. I think was the real puller.
What is the best part of your life today without drugs?
Oh, that's really hard. I don't know. Just waking up. I have a son that's 22, and I have a son that's 3. And
wow.
and I raised my first set of kids, and I had a couple of stepkids, you know, and I raised them without being in touch at all. I mean, I lost a daughter in a car wreck at 15, and I was high, so I missed it. You know, I just went all poor me through the whole thing. And now, I mean, I'm raising my son, my 3-year-old son. He's never seen me high. You know, he's never going to have to deal with high Daniel. You know, he's going to have to deal with me. I mean, I'm living it, and I'm every day I wake up and I just do things with him. You know, and my stepchildren. You know, I mean, it's I have a family. You know, I'm living a life.
You and I were talking the other day, Dan, about how not only are you learning to live sober, but you're learning to put things like values in your life that you never had before. And I know from working in the field for a long time that some people that come into recovery really don't get to go back to something. They really have to start over. And I think, isn't that in a sense what you were describing, is that you are scripting a brand new existence for yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I had to, you know, they say, I mean, it's with recovery, it's change of behavior patterns and belief patterns. And I mean, I had to scrap everything that I'd known. And when it came down to it, that was the easiest thing that I ever did, you know, when I actually just let go of all that stuff, you know, and everything that I was, and just be willing to accept a little bit of knowledge and teaching and learning, you know, every day's new. I'm even driving a station wagon now. and that's just something I never thought that I would do.
Dan the station wagon.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
I'd like to ask Rebecca to read us a definition of methamphetamine provided by the National Institute of Drug Abuse.
Okay, I have the official NIDA definition, and it says, methamphetamine is an addictive stimulant drug that strongly activates certain systems in the brain. Methamphetamine is closely related chemically to amphetamine, but the central nervous system effects of methamphetamine are greater. Both drugs have some medical uses, primarily in the treatment of obesity, but their therapeutic use is limited. Methamphetamine is made in illegal labs and has a high potential for abuse and dependence. Street meth is referred to by many names, such as speed, meth, and chalk. In fact, it's interesting, this talks about treatment of obesity, because Terry and I were talking on the way down that sometimes people get into meth addiction trying to lose weight and thinking that if they take speed, they'll lose some weight, and pretty soon they're hooked. And most of the meth addicts that we see come in very, very thin. In fact, Dan, weren't you very thin when you first came in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
About 175 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, aren't most addicts, when they come into recovery, malnourished?
Often. Yeah. It depends on the drug. It depends on their experience with it. But particularly with meth, any kind of the speed, cocaine, meth, amphetamine.
The system tends to slough off the vitamins and the minerals
right.
and the nutrients of the
right.
food, so that you don't really benefit from having had that, even though you've eaten a good meal.
Right.
It looks like you're eating well, but
yeah.
not necessarily getting where it needs to be
right.
to keep you healthy. Right. Dan, what kind of information would you give somebody out there that might still be using?
You don't have to be insane, and there's still hope.
Well, that's something people need to know, that the hope is there. It hasn't gone away. It's just because we haven't maybe realized how to get hold of the hope and put it into our lives. Oh, that's really great. Okay, I want to remind our listeners that if they want to contact me for counseling or to support this program, please call 253-845-4907. Your contributions will help keep this program on the air. Or if you wish to sponsor this program, call Clay at 253-584-1480. We are going to be having an opportunity for you to call in with your questions before the end of the show about intervention, which some people have a lot of concern about. So get your pencil out. If you wish to call Pierce County, 253-584-1480. Pierce County, 253-584-1480. Or King County, toll-free. Don't dial a 1, just 253-804-5765. 253-804-5765. And get ready to ask questions about methamphetamine addiction or treatment. And also family intervention. And we'll be back in just shortly a few minutes, and stay tuned. Thank you. This is Marilyn, and I'm back with Solutions with Marilyn, and so glad to have the people here from Olalla Recovery Centers, and I will try to keep that correct today and call it the accurate name. We have with us at this point in time Terry Jones, Program Director of Olalla Recovery Centers. And Terry, I wanted to ask you about what people would look for in the signs and symptoms of an addicted person.
Well, Marilyn, initially what you're looking for is signs of abuse of a substance. And generally what that looks like in a short-term user is an alarming decreased appetite and a person that doesn't seem to need any sleep anymore. Those would be the initial early warning signs of methamphetamine abuse or addiction for a family member or concerned friend. Initially, when a person enters into methamphetamine use, basically what they're after is a very, very intense euphoria. Unlike anything you or I would experience in our day-to-day lives. You know, and that euphoria is extremely powerful, and the individual wants to achieve that over and over again. What stimulants do is provide us with a great amount of energy so that we don't need sleep and we don't need food. You know, so people tend to lose an alarming amount of weight when they become addicted to methamphetamine. And because they're not eating and they're not sleeping right, hallucinations may follow, delusional thinking, irrational behavior, sometimes violence and aggression follow as well, especially during the period following a binge. You know, some people who use methamphetamine will go days at a time. And at that point, there's actually not as much euphoria being experienced as an effort to avoid a crash. And what a crash is an intense feeling of dysphoria, or a very, very bad feeling, you know, at the end of the high. And methamphetamine users will basically keep using in an effort to not feel that bad. So aggression and hostility and anger certainly are at their peak at that point, you know, following a rush or a period of extended use. And delusional thinking and hallucinations are not that unusual. There's a term out there to describe a period of extended use, avoiding this crash, called tweaking. And that is probably when a methamphetamine addict is at the most dangerous point, and the most irrational thinking. The central nervous system is severely stressed at that point.
What does tweaking involve?
Basically, what is happening is the neurotransmitters in the brain basically are not functioning at an optimal level anymore. That, combined with a lack of nutrition and a lack of sleep, just provides distorted thinking and irrational behavior. Certainly, we've heard stories of people that are completely outside of their normal personality structure at that point, and are going places and doing things to other people that they would absolutely not do in their normal unaffected state.
Is that comparable to a blackout for an alcoholic?
That's a really good question. Actually, what a blackout is for an alcoholic is a complete amnesia. A person is up and functioning and doing things, but will have absolutely no recollection of that. The difference in methamphetamine use, however, is that a person is actually aware of what's going on while they're in this period of tweaking, but is completely out of control. Right. In fact, may not be able to differentiate between what is real and what is imagined.
Well, isn't that pretty much what addiction's about, is getting out of reality?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What does a meth-addicted person look like to a counselor? If I were to go in and I were addicted, what would the counselor do or look for, or how would that relationship develop?
Well, initially what we're looking for is signs and symptoms of addiction, and what we look at is the amount of the drug that's used, frequency, duration. We're looking at effects on major life symptoms, on health, on family structure. Sometimes there's legal issues involved. So we're looking at disruption in all of the major life areas. With methamphetamine addiction, actually, it's not very difficult to diagnose. You know, by the time we see people in our center, there have been significant issues going on in their life. And actually, by the time they arrive at an inpatient setting, they really cannot stop using anymore. Truly the hallmark of addiction. You know, where if I'm addicted now, I'm not using any longer to get high. I'm using to stave off withdrawal symptoms.
Exactly. What's the difference between other drugs and meth?
Well, methamphetamine is a stimulant. It's not unlike cocaine. However, cocaine produces a high and leaves the system much more rapidly. With methamphetamine, a person can stay high for several more hours than when under the influence of cocaine. And of course, it's very much less expensive, mm-hmm. and can be manufactured easily in one's backyard, as you heard from Dan,
right.
with household products. So that makes it much more affordable to the general population. Doctors as well aren't as inclined to prescribe weight loss aids, amphetamines, as they used to back in the 50s and 60s. So methamphetamine has become very popular amongst teenagers in order to lose weight. But addiction occurs very rapidly. In an alcoholic, you may see the the progression of the disease takes several years. With methamphetamine, it may be only weeks or months. So the family actually is rather shocked by that whole process as well, and may be in a great state of denial about what is occurring. Although the dysfunction at the end is the same with all drugs. That's what we see. By the time someone becomes addicted, they've lost a lot. You know, if nothing else, a sense of self.
Well, that's really fascinating to know. Do you also deal with other drug-dependent people in Olalla?
Yes, we do. We deal with all major drugs of abuse. We treat all those drugs. We don't do methadone maintenance treatment. We are an abstinence-based program. With methamphetamine, we've seen an amazing rise in the amount of admissions for that particular drug listed as the drug of choice. Often methamphetamine is used with alcohol, marijuana, sometimes opiates, heroin, or other prescription opiates to avoid the crash part as an aid to come down. Lots of polydrug abuse. But methamphetamine use is definitely on the rise.
Oh, that's not what we want to hear, is it? All right. What can a person expect at Olalla Recovery Centers?
When folks enter Olalla Recovery Centers, they're typically nervous and scared. You know, so we make an effort when someone enters to certainly try to put them at ease as quickly as possible. You know, we'll do an intake with one of our staff, allow the individual to meet their primary counselor. They're assigned a primary counselor and a primary group in treatment while they'll do the bulk of the work of recovery. They will attend a large amount of classes, lectures, films. You know, we strongly believe in educating, you know, arming folks with information and education. We also treat this in a holistic manner in that we believe that the disease has affected every individual on a mental, emotional, and spiritual basis, physical as well, and our recovery program strives to address all of those areas. And so we are the primary counselors, and as well as the rest of the staff, are working on identifying an individualized treatment plan for each person with those areas in mind. You know, educating in terms of allowing them to understand how this disease has affected their mental capacities and ability to think rationally and make good decisions. There's a lot of emotional healing that goes on. We really encourage people to process what has happened to them and how they feel about that. Spiritually, we offer a wide array of services in order to meet those needs, since people come, you know, with a variety of different spiritual beliefs, as well as the physical health. You know, basically, that's our main goal, is to get people stabilized. We only have 3 weeks. It's not a long period of time. So basically, we look at stabilizing the individual, getting them feeling much better, and then working after that on a very solid continuing care plan. The real work happens when the person leaves.
Well, that's interesting. When someone does leave, what's the best way to prevent relapse?
A very strong, solid recovery plan, or continuing care plan, absolutely. We encourage everyone to enter an outpatient program in their home community once they leave our center. And we really leave that up for the outpatient providers to do, again, an individual assessment and determine how frequently that person should come in, typically 1 to 3 times per week. But there's a great variance there. We also encourage support meetings, and that may be 12-step meetings, AA or NA. It could be church groups. It could be rational recovery, any means of clean and sober support back in their community as well. And we're also, again, assessing for other problems and other issues. If there's mental health issues going on, then we encourage them to get hooked into those services. If there's abuse at home, we get them plugged into those services. So we're really looking at identifying where the major triggers are for relapse and making sure the resources are recommended for every one of those areas.
Well, that's really a total program that you have over there. I'm really impressed. I've always have liked what you've done over there, and know that so often addiction can cover up other problems, and that's what you're saying, is that you try to be prepared that if those problems start to arise in recovery, that they have the opportunity and the information of where to go for more help.
That's correct. Well, statistically, we know that the longer a person is in treatment, the better chances they are to stay clean and sober. You know, statistically, that's been played out over and over again, and I think it's particularly important with this drug. There's been such damage to the central nervous system. This drug is extremely toxic with the chemicals that are used to make it, that, you know, I don't think we can anticipate the brain being back to normal for 1 to 2 years, if ever.
Well, that's really sad to hear that it might be permanent damage.
There could be some permanent damage, that's right.
And so people need to be aware, if you know somebody that needs help or you have somebody in your family that needs help, that sounds like the place to call would be Olalla Recovery Centers, and to get the information you need so that your person can find the help that they're looking for and actually probably want, but they just don't know how to get out of the circumstances they're in. It's kind of like having the covers over your head, and how do you get out from under getting through that denial and actually getting the help that everyone wants. Did you have some other things, Terry, that you wanted to share while you were with us today?
Well, let's see.
I have something to ask, Terry, because this comes up a lot when I'm talking to people. Talk a little bit about the difference between physical dependence and addiction. Because some people don't know that there is a difference, and they think in terms of they're both one and the same.
Well, actually, addiction progresses through stages. They're basically, you can kind of categorize it as progressing through an early stage, a middle stage, and an end stage or late stage. And physical dependence, the actual need to have the drug in order to function, to get out of bed, to stave off withdrawal symptoms, occurs in the very end stages or the late stages of the disease. So if that's what you're looking for, is daily use, I have to have it to function, I can't function without it, then you're going to miss addiction in a lot of cases.
Also, I guess withdrawal is a part of the physical addiction.
Absolutely.
You can be, or physical dependence, rather, whereas you can be addicted, but it may not be physical dependence.
That's right, exactly. In the early stages of the addictive disease, you don't actually see that need to have the drug. You know, people can use occasionally. What you see in the early stages of addiction basically is cellular adaptation or tolerance developing, meaning that I can use more and more of the drug and still function, or I need more and more of the drug to get high. You know, and that's the hallmark of the early stages. In the middle stages, you begin to see problems occurring around that. With methamphetamine, it would be the weight loss. It would be dental problems. You know, methamphetamine is terribly damaging to the enamel on teeth. You know, so dentists sometimes actually are the first ones to catch this and bring this to a person's attention that there might be something going on here if they're savvy enough.
Well, that's fascinating. I would have not have thought of that. So we're all learning here today and hearing some valuable information that will help you better identify methamphetamine addiction and hopefully help people that are involved with that disease. Remember that next we're going to have call-in people for the next part of our program, and we're going to be talking about intervention. Pierce County, the number is 253-584-1480. And in King County, pick up your phone and call 253-804-5765. We are so glad to have our guests here today. Stay tuned and hear some more. Thank you. Welcome back. We're so glad to have you with us, learning all this valuable information from Rebecca Smith and from Terry Jones of Olalla Recovery Centers. Remember, Crystal Voyage is one of our sponsors in Freight House Square. They have all your metaphysical needs over there. Join them every day whenever you need a gift or something for yourself. They have wonderful things to choose from. Also, Evelyn Mulvey of Partners Counseling provides the help you need for peace of mind. Call her at 253-839-3642. And we have today another sponsor of our program, but they're in the studio, not just advertising and sponsoring us as they usually do, but they're right here. Olalla Treatment and recovery centers are valuable in our support of this program. And if you choose to support this program like they are by having a commercial space, call the station, play 253-584-1480. And if you wish to reach me for counseling or to contribute to keep this program on the air, call me at 253-845-4907. I want to remind you that next week is Dr. James Wanless, author and creator of the Revolutionary Voyager Tarot Deck. And if you have questions about that, he's going to be a wonderful person to ask. A lot of people have concerns about that. Also, I want to give you the phone numbers, 253-584-1480 for Pierce County, and for King County, 253-804-5765. That's so you can ask your questions about family intervention or any questions you have about meth addiction. We are going to be talking with Terry and Rebecca this section and finding out more about family intervention. Rebecca, would you like to read the description of family intervention in an article that you put together?
Thanks, Marilyn. Yes, I would. I think that one of the things that often happens right off the bat with people when they call and ask about it is they want to know what the process looks like. So let me just refer to this article I put together for our newsletter. And it says, intervention should be treated as a process rather than a single act. The goal of intervention is recovery for the entire family rather than just treatment for the addict. The purpose of the intervention process is to change the dynamic within the family so intervention can occur. Intervention must protect the addict and the family from adverse consequences. So with that in mind, I usually, when I sit down with the family to talk about whether intervention is appropriate for them, I describe the process. And let me, if you want, I could just kind of go through that a little bit. And
I Terry, think our listeners would love to
okay,
hear that.
And Terry, if you'd like to jump in with something, feel free. Basically, what I do is I have a family either come in for, and by the way, we do free intervention counseling to determine whether it's appropriate for a family to actually go ahead and do an intervention, or we can coach people through the intervention process if in the counseling session it is determined that they have a strong enough family unit and a core person to do it. So basically what happens is we talk about the addict in regards to how their behavior has affected each individual person in the room, and we try to pick people who are individually important to the addict, not someone who has a bone to pick or someone who really needs to say something. What I usually say to the family is, who in this room would be of significance to the individual needing treatment? Who would they listen to?
And such as a boss?
A boss is a really good one. A special grandmother, a child that's old enough to participate and certainly, you know, makes sense that they be involved in the process. Because often I'll get a family member who is fed up, doesn't want to deal with this anymore, and they have a lot of anger. And I have to remind the family over and over again that the process of intervention is lovingly confront the individual. But lovingly is the key to it, because if that person really genuinely feels cared for and has someone in the room, particularly the person that they pay that most attention to, transmit to them that this process is about helping them rather than a punitive approach, they're going to pay attention to it. The key is not to corner the individual and force that person to make a decision. The key is to get to the heart of what's going on in that individual and hopefully have them open up to the possibility that people around them really do love them and care about them. But getting back to the process, the formal intervention is a three-step process in that I meet with the family, I explain how it works, and then I ask each person that's going to be part of the intervention process to think about a particular situation that they can write a letter about. So what they will do is script a letter, and much like we're orchestrating a play, and in that letter they say to the individual, "Dear John, you know, I love you and I have always been close to you and I've always thought the best of you. However, the last time we got together for dinner, you drank several drinks, you embarrassed us at the restaurant, and I had a hard time getting you back to the car. I want the old John back. So I would really like it if you would get an assessment, or I would really like it if you go to treatment. It's important for the family to decide what the outcome is going to be before the intervention occurs, and for everyone to be on the same page with that, because you don't want that to be up for discussion during the intervention process. It's also important in that letter for that person who's writing to say to the individual, I want the old blah, blah, blah back. In other words, referring back to the relationship they used to have with that individual before they were using addictively. So that's a key. The next thing is we rehearse the letters, we get together again, we go through the process of reading them to each other. This allows the family members to get out any emotional stuff that they need to deal with, because it's usually pretty emotional, and people cry and they get upset, and it's best to do that at least ahead of time once. It's not that it's not okay to cry during the intervention, but we don't want any surprises. Therefore, you know, it really is a well-orchestrated play. Then we set the time for the actual event. And we hopefully can do it in a place that is comfortable for the addict, often in the home. There's an element of surprise about it, which is difficult because everyone has to keep it a secret. We don't want the addict to know this is going to happen. This is one kind of intervention. There's another kind of intervention where the addict is brought into the process and the family works with a therapist and actually goes through a series of meetings to try to get the person into treatment. But the formal intervention that I generally do is the one where there's an element of surprise. Then we do the intervention. The bag is packed. The treatment center, if that's the outcome, has been picked. The insurance has been checked. Everything is ready to go, and if the addict agrees to go to treatment, any excuses that they may come up with, like the dog needs care or I've got to, you know, pay my bills, there's usually someone in that group who agrees, oh, I'll take care of that for you, John, you don't have to worry about it, so that we can whisk that person right off into the car and into the treatment center so they get a chance to begin the assessment process and determine if, you know, they're appropriate for treatment.
That's interesting to hear. You mentioned choosing a treatment center as part of the plan, so that's already set. Do you have some questions people might ask or curious about, so then when they're picking a treatment center, it fits their needs?
Right. We are part of a process called CARF. In fact, I'm going to defer to Terry just on a description, if you wouldn't mind. Could you describe what the CARF process involves, because you've been our kind of lead point person on getting our CARF accreditation?
Sure. CARF is a national accreditation agency. It's voluntary, and agencies actually go to this organization and say, we believe that, you know, we meet your standards, and their standards are extremely rigorous. You know, we believe we meet your standards and would like you to put your stamp of approval on our organization. They typically offer 1 to 3 year accreditation periods, and at the end of that, they'll come back and then review your organization again and determine that you are, in fact, still meeting those standards. And CARF actually has some tips on how to provide or how to find a good treatment center. Basically, phone interviews are good initially. You know, ask some questions, be clear on what your need is, you know, and find out if that program can meet those needs. You know, take a tour. How does it feel when you walk in? You know, are you comfortable with the appearances and the accommodations? Talk to staff members. You know, ask questions. Ask them what their mission statement is and their philosophy, possibly, or ask them about the treatment protocol and family program services. You know, how can the family members participate in this process? All good programs should have a family component.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. That's how I first got involved with recovery, was through a family program. And I feel they're very valuable to support that person in recovery, so the whole family is working together in harmony.
Absolutely.
And can be there for each other, which is not what happened in the prior situation.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's called the family disease,
right?
Because we know from our own experiences in the field that it isn't just the addict or alcoholic who is affected. The longer their addiction goes on, like Terry was talking about with methamphetamine, because that process sometimes isn't very long, sometimes the family's blindsided and doesn't see. I hardly ever get a call about addiction to meth, once in a while, because generally it doesn't, you know, take very long before the person's completely bottomed out, and the family doesn't see it and understand it as well as maybe the family of an alcoholic who's lived with it day after day, year after year.
Right. How does Olala stack up with your program, CARF?
Well, we have several things that we tell people when they call us. In terms of being nationally accredited, that's a big piece of what we offer because the process is quite extensive. And like Terry was saying, they look at several pieces of our program to determine if we meet their criteria. It's similar to a hospital-based or a hospital program being a JAHCO, J-A-H-C-O, approved. I'd like to talk a little more about Olala specifically. We've been in business since 1969. We have a holistic approach and basically a low-cost approach.
Well, that's all wonderful information for everybody out there. I hope that you've learned a lot today. You've gotten answers to your questions. Hopefully you will be in touch with Olala if your need arises in your family or in a friend. And please feel free to call and ask any questions you have right at the Recovery Center. We're glad that you were here today. Remember that next week Dr. James Wanless will be our guest, and he'll be calling from we'll call him in California. So it'll be a long-distance call, but you can still call in with your questions. So we'll see you next week, and we want to thank Rebecca for bringing these wonderful people
on our
panel for this enlightening and informative time, and we'll see you again. Thanks. We'll see you next week on Wednesdays at noon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Maryland Solutions. Listen again next week for another informative show with guests from coast to coast. For a copy of today's program or a copy of her new book, Roses Have Thorns, and videotapes on empowerment and spiritual tools for healing domestic violence, write to KLAY in care of Maryland Solutions, 10025 Lakewood Drive Southwest, Tacoma, Washington, 98499. Or visit her website at Maryland@angelicasgifts.com.
Many people are looking for a new direction and a lift in spirit. Hello, I'm Reverend Marilyn, a counselor, teacher for over 30 years, and a spiritual advisor for addictions, codependency, domestic violence, past lives, and holistic healing. Join me every Wednesday at noon for Marilyn Solutions, a program sure to be of interest to everyone. We will talk with guests from coast to coast, offering a wide range of talents and information. That's Marilyn Solutions, Wednesdays at noon on your news and information station, KLAY 1180.